Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Good morning, I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and I welcome you to Your Partner in Success Radio. And today my guest is Fail Coach Miha Motlieski, and I'm going to get him to pronounce his name properly. He coached me a few minutes ago. I'm not sure I got it correct, but I tried. In 2009, Miha had four companies go bankrupt overnight, landing him in $5 million in debt. I don't know about you, that makes my eyes water. So he was contemplating suicide to escape the pain. As he looked over the balcony, he had a life-saving aha moment, and he realized that failure really is a normal part of life, and he began admitting to himself that he had failed, and he came to recognize that he needed to stop blaming others and the circumstances. It really was his failures for whatever the reasons were. We all need to understand that. So this is the turning point when he made a choice to learn from his failures so that he could do things differently in the future and help, you know, others, people like you and me. So since then, he has climbed back to create a business and scaled it to eight figures in less than a year, and his life mission is to help people develop a healthy relationship with failure, especially entrepreneurs and solopreneurs. Miha is here to share his stories and tips and advice on how to deal with the small and large, and by large I mean massive, $5 million in debt is massive, failures that we experience on a regular basis. So he's got about six touch points, and I'm going to have him just start talking because there's a lot to discuss here. Miha, welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. It's really good to have you here.
Well, hello, Denise. It's a huge, huge pleasure to be your guest. I've been a follower of yours and your podcast for quite some time now, and this is like a dream come true, honestly.
Oh, thank you. I think I teared up a little bit there. That was very kind of you. I appreciate that a lot. How badly did I mangle your name? I need to know.
No, that was quite okay. And like I told you, even in my country, it's not a very common surname, so I've been used since very young age to my surname being butchered in so many different ways that I'm used to it already. But yeah, you were quite on spot. So
okay.
Kudos on
well,
that.
Pronounce it for us. Tell us how to really correctly call you.
So it's Miha Motlieski.
So I wasn't way off. All right. I have one of those last names, but nobody can spell mine or get it correct. But yours is much, much different than mine. So yeah, I don't feel nearly as bad as, you know, trying to correct people on my name either. But I love the way it sounds. So say it one more time, because I think it's got a lovely sound.
Well, it's Motlieski.
Okay, I like that. Okay, so listen, we've had a couple of chats. We had our pre-interview, and we were talking a little bit earlier in my virtual green room. You've got a heck of a story. I mean, when I first read your story, I just went, oh. I mean, I think my head bowed a little bit just because $5 million. And then when I got to the point where you really were at the end of your rope, so to speak, I just had to chat with you. I had to speak with you because you've got a lot of story to share. You have a lot of tips and advice to share. But mostly, you are here to help us get comfortable with failure and understand failure. And I think more importantly, to not let failure define who you are or stop you. So let's get chatting.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, like, yes, those numbers might sound huge to most people, but it's not really, you know, so much about the numbers. It was because I've told this story many times, you know, on stages and so on. And then people approach me who maybe, you know, lost just a small fraction of what I lost. But the emotions, the negative self-talk and all of that might be just the same. And I feel that when we really go deep into those emotions and everything that was happening in my head and so on, quite a few people might connect with that, even though if they might not connect with the numbers.
See, that makes perfect sense to me, because we can beat ourselves up for the smallest of things, you know, something that nobody else really thinks is all that big a deal. But we can run that loop in our head over and over and over again. We're all guilty of it. I'm guilty of it. So basically, if I understand your story correctly, you had to just say, okay, this is not the end of my world unless I make it so. I can work this. I can, you know, make this part of my story, learn from it and share from it and keep going. And thank goodness you did.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I had a childhood that was a very special kind of adversity. I had the most perfect childhood. But the thing was that, you know, everybody in our family, because I was the only child, you know, grandparents, parents, everybody was telling me how great I am, how amazing I am, how I can do no wrong. I was never held accountable or and anything. And that created almost like a bubble in my head, where whenever something good happened to me, I would just take it for granted. I wasn't grateful for the good times. It was, you know, normal, since I am that next reincarnation of Jesus Christ. But then whenever something bad happened to me, I was always able to find somebody or something else to blame for that, because, you know, how can this perfect child, the fifth element, do anything wrong? It was impossible for me to, you know, even understand that I can do something wrong. It must be something or somebody else. And, you know, my companies went bankrupt, the ones that went bankrupt overnight. That was partly because of the financial crisis back in 2008. I mean, in reality, it was because of the lack of solid foundations, but, you know, the financial crisis just speed up the whole thing. And it was so easy to find blame. You know, everybody, all the media, everybody was talking recession, crisis, governments not doing what they were supposed to, and so on. And it was just so easy to blame everything on things outside of me. But the true aha moment happened when I did realize, and yes, it was probably seconds away from me letting go and just jumping from the balcony, that nobody forced me to, you know, go into a huge real estate project. Nobody forced me to co-sign the agreement with the bank, with all my other companies, with all my assets on the line and so on. Nobody forced me to hire people that I hired. Nobody forced me to partner with people that I partnered with and so on. And it was really that dialogue. I mean, if I just remember that time on the balcony, I still don't know how I even climbed on the other side, but then I remember distinctly holding myself with just one, with the left hand, and I was kind of like already 45 degrees inclined over the edge, and I was only on the fifth floor, and I was looking down, and I was thinking, will I do this right, or will I just end up on a wheelchair, because that will not solve anything. And that moment, I just started yelling at myself. It was like there's these two Mijas on that balcony, and the one Mija is yelling at the other Mija, and I used some pretty, pretty juicy language, so I'm not going to repeat that here on your show. But, you know, it was along the line, oh, you did this, you did that, you messed up, and so on. And it was hearing to myself, you, that really created that aha moment. But the funny thing was, when I realized, oh, it was all me, that was when it really hit me. I can do it differently. And because I already did it once, I can do it again, and I can do it better and bigger. And that was that little ray of light that I needed, because I always was a fighter. I just, you know, in those months between the bankruptcy and that moment on the balcony, this darkness overflew me completely, and I saw no light, no tunnel, no nothing. And this gave me that little ray of light to climb back in and to start fighting again.
You said a couple of things that I'm just fascinated with. One is 2008. I mean, I remember it. Fortunately, my company didn't fail, but I'm a service industry, so I still had plenty of clients and grew, but a lot of people didn't. And I remember it as being just the year of collective hysteria. Everybody was hysterical. And I'll be frank with you, I quit listening. I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want all of that hysteria and, you know, things, you know, everything's gone to crap. But I didn't want it in my head. I just didn't want to operate that way. But the other thing you said, which I find very fascinating, I wanted to ask you about, is that you started speaking out loud to yourself. And have you found that when you actually articulate it out loud, you're not just running it around in your brain like you do with a washing machine, you just keep going cycle to cycle, but you're actually speaking it out loud and forcing yourself to hear yourself. Do you think that was a big part of what had you, you know, your aha moment?
I would say yes. I mean, when I'm working with people who are dealing with failure and so on, I see that one of the first things how the healing can even start is when you let it out. Most of the time, we just have that inside of us. We marinate that in our brain, and we have this internal monologue. But it's one you, once you either write it out or let it out and speak it, that's when the healing starts. It's not the healing itself, but it starts. The worst thing that you can
do when you're
faced with failure. Yes.
Yeah, when you can hear yourself, it's a whole different dialogue. The dialogue that we get stuck in our brains, those loops, I call that stinking thinking, and it's not original. Either Dolly Parton said it or, you know, somebody famous said it, but it stuck with me. It's stinking thinking. But you're not getting it out, and you're not hearing it. You're not quarreling with it and saying, hey, hang on a second. You can't talk to me like that. Even when you're pointing the finger at your own self, you can't talk to me like that. And I'm with you. I find it very healthy to just stand under a tree or in front of your refrigerator or wherever you happen to be and say, I'm going to speak this out loud, dissect it, and fix it. I do it all the time. But I live alone, so
yeah,
I can get by with speaking to myself out loud. I do it quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, it almost like it becomes a different reality once it's
exactly
said out loud.
Well, you have to respond to it. When you're in that dialogue, this is just my own personal observation, when you're in that loop, that stinking thinking, there's nothing to break that momentum. There's nothing to cut that rubber band, if you will. And it just keeps on going, and it doesn't stop, and you just accede to it and say, okay, fine, that's the way it is. But it isn't the way it is. But when you have that argument or conversation with yourself out loud, or as you say, write it, yeah, I don't know about you, a lot of my most interesting thoughts come underwater when I'm in the bathtub or the shower. And, you know, I was, oh, geez, I need to get that up. You know, I need to write that down somewhere. So I went to Amazon and I bought crayon, bathtub crayons. I scribble all over my shower wall. I do. And as soon as I'm done, I don't lose any of my brilliant thoughts, because let's face it, when we're in the shower, we're all brilliant. We're all geniuses. And, you know, I grab my iPhone, I take a picture of all my scribbles, and then I wash the wall, and I didn't lose anything. But you have to get it out, so you can't keep it internal.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, my experience, like, I get all the best ideas and all the best thoughts when I'm out walking with my dogs. I have 4 dogs.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's impossible to not be present. It's like the walks with my dogs are like meditation. I bring nothing with me because you can't handle 4 dogs and anything else. And that's where, you know, my creative juices, I guess, kind of come while on the walks.
See, I do the same thing. I've tried to meditate, Mia. I have tried and tried. I've tried everybody and their grandmother has given me advice on meditation. I fall asleep or I drool. I don't really meditate. I don't know what happens. It doesn't work. But when I'm walking with the dog, I go into what I call a walking meditation. The other day, I live in a small neighborhood, 3 streets deep, 3 streets wide. I got so deep into whatever it was that I was thinking that I walked right past my house and got lost. I had to stop and turn around and figure out where I was. So I completely understand that. It's a good time to just clear your brain.
Yes. I mean, at the end of the day, meditation, the way I understand it, is really just that. You focus, you know, with you know, how normally people do it is they would sit down and focus on the breathing. So you just try to declutter your head of all the gazillion thoughts going through it all the time. So in reality, when you are focused on one thing and one thing only, I think that's like really the state of meditation. You know, the way I focus on my breathing when I'm trying to do it sitting down, when I have to focus on my thoughts and trying to, you know, untangle all those leashes and everything because they're constantly jumping over each other and so on. I have to be 100% focused and in the moment. And I guess that's like the definition of meditation anyway, being present,
right,
being in the moment.
Right. And not churning through whatever the heck it was that you were churning through an hour ago that wasn't getting you anywhere positive. So, yeah, I really enjoy walking with my dog in the evening because it's nice. It's quiet. It's a very quiet neighborhood. And she visits her telegraph, you know, stations. Every mailbox is a telegraph company to her. And we, you know, just after a while, I catch myself not even knowing where I am, which is fine because it's a very small neighborhood. But there's something very revealing about walking the dog or being in the shower and just not going through those constant, oh my God, you know, you're silly, you're lazy, you're fat, you're stupid, you're ugly, you know, whatever, the things we tell ourselves. And boy, do we talk ugly to ourselves.
Yes, we really do. We really do.
Okay, so let's go back to failure because one of the things that, and we all fail. I mean, as an entrepreneur, solopreneur, which is what I am, I tell people if you don't have a cast iron stomach and you don't understand that you're going to fail probably multiple times a day, small, big, you know, in between, you probably need to go do something a little bit different because this is not, like, I enjoy my life. This is the life I created, the business I created. It's not easy. Nobody said it was going to be easy. But, you know, some days you're just like, oh, what the heck happened? And other days you're like, oh, that was a piece of cake. I'm going to do that again tomorrow. And then you, oh, what the heck happened? So yeah, we're in that round robin all the time. But your story is that you want to show us, you know, about failure and how we can create that zone of comfort with failure and how to be comfortable with it. And I know that sounds wrong. I mean, people are listening going, what's she talking about? You have to be comfortable with failure because it is going to happen. Is that what you're talking about? I think that's what we have described.
Yeah, I mean, you know, failure is just a regular part of life. Just how we will all die eventually, how we all have to pay taxes, and, you know, we all fail along the journey. And the thing is really like understanding what failure really is and establishing healthy relationship with failure. And that healthy relationship with failure is a logical, not emotional relationship, because those emotions cloud our vision. It's the logic that really helps us understand failure. And so if I just dive a little bit into it, when you are an entrepreneur, let's say, you know, the definition of us entrepreneurs is that we are a little bit crazy. You know, we have these big dreams, big goals. We want to change the world, go to Mars, impact millions, and so on. The bigger, the crazier your dreams are or your goals are, the more you have to be outside of the comfort zone. Nothing magical ever happens in the comfort zone. And so when you are outside of the comfort zone, what does that mean? It means that you are doing things for the first time. And when you're doing things for the first time, the likelihood that you won't succeed on your first try is much bigger than you actually succeeding on your first try. Now, add emotions into the mix and things can become quite hectic. You know, if you wake up and you say, oh, you know what, I'm going to make myself X for breakfast, and there's really not much of emotions there, and you burn them and you just say, well, you know what, fuck it, I'll just chunk them into the trash and I'll make a new X. When we add emotions, so let's say you have this amazing date with the love of your life and you want to impress her with your cooking skills, and you decide to make a risotto, which is a quite difficult dish to make. And then that risotto turns out to be all dry, not creamy. You might consider that a failure, not because of, you know, there's nothing different between the risotto and the eggs. You tried cooking something, it failed, move on, but because of the emotions attached to that risotto, because you're doing that for your a loved one, you have high positive emotions. Maybe you start saying to your brain like, oh, you know, everything depends on this dinner and so on. And the more we blow up the positive emotions that we are expecting when we will reach a certain goal or when we will accomplish a certain thing, the higher the negative emotions when we don't do that. And so if you look at entrepreneurs, you know, there's always a why we are doing what we're doing. Maybe we want to provide for our family. Maybe we want to, you know, be the first one that created something. But it's always attached with huge positive emotions on the other side of the entrepreneurial journey. And so when things don't go the way they should be, or that we planned them, we go into very negative emotions. And that's when we say failure. And so having that healthy relationship with failure is super important, because those negative emotions will kind of drag you into this roller coaster. And you know, it can take a lot of time to bounce back from those negative emotions. But the key is to bounce back as soon as possible and move on and try again and try something different and learn from it. And eventually, the more you try of what's not working, you find things that do work and you achieve successes. So the road to success is through failing fast, but failing forward. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And what I'm hearing from you is that, I mean, we're going to fail. I do it all the time. I mean, I may fail before I'm even out of bed, which is tough to do. But sometimes you listen, you know, I try to wake up every morning with gratitude. I used to wake up and my mom had sent me this birthday card, you know, it says, when you wake up, the devil says, "Oh crap, she's awake," because I would always hit the floor running. And now I take the time to express my gratitude and be very, very grateful about everything. If I don't do that and I just jump out of bed, it's like, "Oh crud, that was my first failure." Don't beat yourself up.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the point you're saying, just don't beat yourself up. You know, you've got another opportunity.
Yeah, don't go into the negative emotions. Don't go into the negative self-talk. That makes the whole thing just worse. It's be logical, be unemotional about that. Focus on the process. Usually, it's always the process leading to a goal or a dream that doesn't happen, but the problem is in the process. Either you are doing the wrong steps and expecting something to happen, which will not, or you have certain bottlenecks in those processes and you haven't found them yet and eliminated them yet, and so you don't have the full flow and you are not reaching your goal in a desired time frame.
Right. And I will say something about bottlenecks. It's always me, always, 100% of the time. If I hit a bottleneck in my company or in my team, I'm the bottleneck. And I have to stop and go, okay, how did this happen? What's the next move? But that's part of logic. It's not like, oh, geez, you know, my guy didn't do this and I didn't, you know, do this. And it's always me. Do you find that to be true with you?
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, I mean, you can't, even when you're delegating, you can't delegate the responsibility. The other day, I was talking with a fellow entrepreneur, and he was venting out about his employee not finishing something in the right way and so on. And I said, well, stop it. I mean, what you're doing right now will not yield anything. You have two things that you need to reconsider and reflect and correct, if you know. So either you have problems with your HR process and you employed somebody who's not fit for that job, or processes that are in place for that particular job are not well done. Go back and improve those processes so that even if you hire 10 more people, they will not be doing the same mistake. It's either of those things. There's no third thing.
Right, right. Standard operating procedures. And do you know what I found? Because when I'm an introvert, I mean, we've talked about this, I am a card-carrying introvert. And when I first began my business, there was no way to bring on a remote team. It just didn't happen. The internet wasn't where it is now. We didn't have the resources that we have now. And I know it sounds like it was 100 years ago. It wasn't. It was 2001, 2002, 2003. Wasn't that long ago. So when I did finally get to the point where I had the wherewithal and the means to hire remote teams, and I love them, by the way, I made the mistake of not guide them, but tell them what to do. And I finally found out that I was doing it all wrong. And I think a lot of us do this. I was doing it all wrong. I wanted them to do it the way I wanted it. They, you know, even if I gave them SOPs, they needed to read my mind. It was ridiculous. And I finally figured out that it was ridiculous. Do you know what I do now? I find people, I never ask any of my team to do something that I can't personally do myself, because I need to know what it is. I need to know how to guide them. But now I look for people who have better skills and who are smarter in some things than I am. And I explain what I need. I bring them into the process. I get their buy-in and I cut them loose. And they do amazing work.
I agree. And that is definitely one way to go about it. But it might not be a good way if you want to scale. And if you want to really scale fast and to something big, because you can't afford to always hire senior people, because the more senior they are, the more costly they are. And often with senior people, you'll see another thing, that if you don't find somebody who's really the perfect fit personality-wise as well, they might be much harder to work with because they're already a very developed person and they have a certain own way of doing things, which is okay if they do the process from start to finish. But the moment they need to start collaborating with each other, it's much harder. It's a challenge. It's not undoable. And as a leader, that's what your job is. But it might be hard to maintain a team of huge experts and really do the whole leadership. So where the freedom comes from is in being able to hire more junior people and have not just processes, but also an internal knowledge base and all HR onboarding processes in place to get them up and running as soon as possible. That gives you a much wider variety of options and opportunities and hence brings a bigger freedom into your life. When you really want to scale your business, you don't want to depend on a particular person by name and surname. It needs to be a system in place where you can almost bring people from a street and onboard them into that process. Now, I know that you can't, if you are in an IT company, of course you can't just find people who have no clue about programming, but you want to be able to hire as junior people as possible because that gives you the biggest freedom and the biggest opportunity for profit as well on a much larger scale.
Well, I understand. When I talk about my team, it's a remote team. It's just me. I own the company. There's just me. And these people are all very skilled. Some are in WordPress. Some are in SEO. I find the people who are very, very good at whatever it is that I need to work in my company. And that's what I mean about better at it and smarter than I am. None of them ever communicate. So it's a slightly, it's a big, big difference. You're talking about a company, like a brick-and-mortar type of company that may be global, international, local. I'm talking about, I work virtually. But I understand what you're saying because I love the idea, where you say you have this onboarding process. And I think I have that. I could tweak it a bit, but it's important because if you can't ask your people if they don't understand what it is that they need to do, you're going to spend an awful lot of time going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and the frustration grows and you don't get anywhere. So we're actually talking about two separate things, but in a way they mesh very, very well.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, what you would be able to do is deconstruct what they are doing, create processes from what they've done, how they did it, and then those things would enable you next time somebody wants a similar thing to hire a more junior person and say, here's how you're going to do it.
That makes sense. Yeah, I had not thought of that. I have been so fixated on getting my team where they need to be and, giving them, you want a happy team, right? You want happy employees. They're not employees as, they're contract employees, but you want them to be happy. You want them to be dialed in. You want them to be able to say, Denise, I really like what you're thinking here, but here's a better way to do it. What do you think? And I do encourage that. I do encourage feedback from my team because I don't know everything. And I tell you, that pains me to admit that, but I don't know everything. None of us do.
No, I absolutely understand you. And for how you do things, that is a very good way of doing it. But now if we try to imagine that, tomorrow Denise wakes up and says, you know what? I want to, feed all the starving children in Africa. What do I need for that? Oh, shit, I need billions. I really need to scale my business. then
right.
these people could be your leaders, but you know, you can't build a big business just on senior people. It doesn't work that way. You need a mix. You need leaders and you need employees, like followers.
Worker bees.
You need,
I call them worker bees.
And you need a mix of you know, junior, senior, and mid-year people. It just doesn't work any other way, because junior might be too junior for certain tasks. Seniors might be too expensive or not wanting to do certain things because it's above what they would do. So you need the mid-years as well in the mix. And, you know, not everybody can be a leader in a big organization. Not everybody can be a follower. So you need to have, like, that mix of your management structure, C-level structure, and so on, and the actual workers who get things done. So, you know, like, for what you're currently doing, and I'm guessing it's more based project by project, and there is not so much of having to work like 10 people on one project, then this, what you're doing right now, is very, very solid way of doing it. The thing is, if you would decide, you know what, I want to scale this up, I don't know, from your, you know, 10 times, 20 times, 50 times what you're doing right now, then, you know, it might not be scalable.
It wouldn't
extent.
Be. Yeah, I'm listening to you going, that wouldn't work. I would have to do something completely different. And I can, you know, tell that just by listening to you. So let's talk about what kind of foundations you need to have. And if I want to feed, you know, millions and millions of people, why not? Tony Robbins does it. A lot of people do it. Why can't I do it? So what kind of foundations do I have to have in place? Because, there's going to be failures. We're talking about failures here. There's going to be, you hit that darn brick wall and you back up and look at it and hit it again. Done that. I think we all do that. We're like, oh, geez, didn't I just bang my head on that thing? But what kind of foundations, Miha, do you have to have in place so that when failure hits you between the eyeballs, you're like, I've been here, I've done this, let's not do this one again, or what the heck was that? Where do people start?
Well, I mean, one thing is, if you have solid foundations, this will also enable you to fail on a lesser extent, because you will be able to recognize failure much sooner, react much sooner. So, you know, that failure will not be as monumental as it might be without foundations in place. So that's one huge benefit of having foundations in place. But then it really depends, you know, where do you see yourself 2-3 years from now? Because, you know, if we look at, let's say, a house, if you only want to build a family house, you won't make foundations for a huge New York style skyscraper. And if you want to build a skyscraper, then having a very small foundation that is only fit for a house will not do. So the same, basically building a business is very similar to how you built a building. So you have to, you know, look a bit ahead and say, where do I want to be in 2-3 years time? And then based on that, that will show you what foundations you need. But let's say some of the general foundations are processes, duplicatable, verified processes. Processes need to be measured. Those numbers need to be turned into KPIs, key performance indicators. KPIs alone won't tell you the whole picture. You need benchmarking. You need to benchmark them against something. Otherwise, they don't make the whole picture, the whole story. Then if you are thinking to go above 7 figures, it's a very good thing to have a solid business intelligence system in place so that you can have quick dashboards and you know, for different levels in your company to quickly see where we are, what's happening, what's going on. that's on one hand, that would be more like the hard foundations. But then, you know, what's my brand story? Who are we as a company? You know, like you have to almost look at your company as a human being, you know. The company needs to have its why. What are the values? If you don't create intentionally company culture, it will be created by itself and it might not be what you want. Company culture is immensely important when you are creating HR processes because it tells you who are we looking for. Because if you are just going for the skills in an organization where people have to work with each other, that won't, you know, skills can be taught more easily than changing somebody's personality. So they need to fit the company culture. From that, you create an HR structure, company structure, and then HR structure to support that company structure. You need to have onboarding processes, internal knowledge base. Now, again, if you only want to have like a six-figure business, a lot of this will not be needed or will be needed in a much lesser extent. If you want to go to 8-9 figures, and that's a different story. You know, in my last startup, we went from zero to multiple 9 figures in 2 years' time. And it was a whole different story when, you know, we were at 7 figures than when we were at 8 and when we were at 9 and when we were at multiple 9 figures. It's a different environment because, you know, at 6 figures, you might have a few virtual assistants that are helping you or a few freelancers. It's a completely different story than when you have to deal with 500 employees or 1,000 employees and so on. So it's you know, it's not one size fits all where you can just say, oh, you have to create this and this and this and this. It's very important to understand where do I want to be in roughly 2 to 3 years? Because if you create too much of foundation, it will kill your profitability, it will increase your bottom line, and it won't make any sense. Now, if your foundations are not enough, then there is huge likelihood of big failures, very huge likelihood. Does that make sense?
It does. Would you give us, do you have an example or two that you can share? Because I know you coach with a lot of people. Yeah. Yeah, particularly what you just said, you know, you have the small foundation that's going to topple. You know, everything above it is going to topple. I'd love to hear some examples because I know you've got them in your own business and those that you coach.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, if you want to just do, you know, a few 6 figures, okay.
I love the ways that you just want to. I know people are going, just? I want it all.
So, I know.
I'm kind of giggling a little bit.
I know. That's something like I'm still, you know, often I have to remind myself, you know, the thing is when you go to 8, 9 and so on, you can already see how to go there. And I have to constantly remind myself when I'm working with people who are new to business in the early stages that they might not see as far as I see. And you know, often I have some reactions.
That's what I'm trying to get from you.
You're crazy. Yeah. So I that's something I have to constantly remind myself. But the thing is, when you want just, you know, a few, like, you know, making 200,000-400,000 a year, yes, you need some processes, but you don't have to, you know, flowchart them. You basically just probably can make in a Word document a few checklists, things like that. You would measure a few conversion numbers in your marketing, your sales, maybe your delivery. You don't have to, you know, create a whole ecosystem just for customer experience. You basically just have to, you know, just be mindful that every now and then you reach out to existing clients, have a chat with them. So everything is done on a much lower scale. But then, you know, imagine if you go to eight or nine figures and you have thousands of clients or even more that you're dealing with. You need a system in place for every little thing, and it has to be super detailed because you can't control everything anymore. You lose that control. You know, with, with five employees, it's easy to be in contact with them every day. You know, if you are working together every day at the end of the work, you can go have a few beers, you talk through the things of what was happening today, make a little plan for tomorrow and so on. But once you're dealing with 100 or 200 or 300 people, it doesn't work that way anymore. You can't have that. So you need strong leadership in between. But you as the CEO need to be that first leader that guides your C-level and middle management leaders to do the right thing with their employees and so on, and their teams.
And that goes back to what you said about culture, company culture.
Yes, it's a very important thing. And, you know, the thing with culture is every company has company culture. Now, the question is, whether you created it intentionally or it was created by itself. And when it's created by itself, it might not be what you want. And I see so many entrepreneurs, you know, they're so focused on selling. And like, the thing is that this foundational stuff is mostly boring to creative entrepreneurs. You know, and it's time consuming, and it's, you know, you don't see an ROI immediately. You don't see how, you know, oh, me sitting down for a few hours every week and just working on my company culture and those things translate immediately into increased sales. So, you know, often entrepreneurs are, okay, so what will bring sales in right away? That's marketing, that's sales, let's focus on that. But if you don't do the other stuff, it creates itself, and then it might not be, and most of the time it's not, what you want. And then you don't fail because of marketing or sales, but you fail because, you know, there's no company culture. People fight amongst each other. People are leaving your company. Maybe good people are leaving because the ones who aren't showing up as much are taking charge of how the whole company culture is created and so on. I mean, there's just so many examples. I can give you an example from a marketing agency that I was helping last year. The owner didn't create, you know, company culture intentionally. And what happened to him was that he was employing people just left and right, like anybody who came to him, recommendations, he would just employ them. At the end of the day, the employees had no respect for leaders because he had no respect for leaders and he wasn't the real leader. They saw him as the one who gives them paycheck. And if he is not respectful to his leaders, then how can you expect employees to be respectful if you as the owner don't respect them? And, you know, everybody's looking at you, the owner, the CEO, and they mimic what you do. And so this company culture was created where leaders were leaving on a monthly basis. And he was like, why are they leaving? Like they get everything, but they didn't get the right support. And you know, he would just create leaders by giving them titles. That's not how you create leaders, not in today's world, you know?
Not in any world.
Yeah. So, in company, everything starts from the head. And if there is no clarity and if there is no leadership at the top, it will just translate into more and more confusion the deeper you go into the company structure. That's the biggest problem. And so he hoped that leaders will somehow manage to establish things by themselves, and he was just sitting in his office hoping that nobody will knock on his door, and you know, even if there are problems, then people will come and tell him. But people don't come and tell you, they go and find a better workplace. You know, things
well,
like
of
that.
Of course they do. It was, right.
It was a very, very, very confusing situation. And yeah, we had to go back to basics, back to step one. And the first thing was, okay, so let's create company culture that we want in this company. And the first thing was, you know, let's see what you, the leader, have to do and change so that you become the real leader and that you show up, not hide behind your office door, hoping that, you know, people will just somehow figure it out by themselves. It doesn't work that way, but I see so many entrepreneurs doing just that.
Well, Mia, how did that work? Because it sounds like this is a company that had been around for a while, I'm guessing. It didn't just kind of pop up 5 years ago. So the issues that I'm guessing from what I'm hearing from you is that these issues were deep-seated. They'd been around for a while, and everybody needed to either change or get gone. How did that work? Because, I mean, you've got a boss up there who really was not trained, apparently, to have this company or build this company. Sounds like he really didn't know what he was doing. And then he expects these leaders to just kind of pop up and take up, you know, take over his job. How did it all work? I mean, how long did it take for this to, you know, get turned around? And was apparently he was willing, I'm guessing, because he came to you. He was more than willing to make those changes, but how painful was it?
Well, it was very painful. It was very long term. And in the beginning, I think what he was expecting was that, oh, I hire a coach and now magically things will correct themselves. We needed, I think, around 3, if not even 4 months, just me trying to get him to see that everything starts with him. You know, he was magically looking for some solution outside of him. And I gave him one solution. I said, well, the only way how this can be solved without you is if you retire into just a shareholder position and hire a professional CEO that knows how to do these things. Or you need to become the CEO, the leader first. And he didn't want to understand that, you know, and he would change a little bit, see some results.
Well, those are both
and then
tough
back
choices.
To,
I mean, if that were me that you were talking with, I would instantly go from logic to, well, you just hurt my feelings instantly. I mean, that's how we operate. You would have to overcome that,
you
just hurt my feelings thing, and then make a decision. So what did he do?
It was a fight, internal fight within him. But, you know, like I always say, I mean, I'm not a yes-man coach. A lot of coaches do that, you know, because they want to grab onto a client and you know, milk them. They don't tell them, like, the reality, you know. Like, I mean, I still try to tell things in the most respectful and good positive way that I can. It's not like, you know, bluntly saying, oh, you need to do this, you know, like but still, you know, as a coach, you can't be a yes man. You need to say it as it is. And it was a fight, internal fight in himself. At the end, he decided to go with the outside CEO. So we worked on that. I helped him find the CEO. And then we worked with a CEO for a while to really lay down all the foundations first. And now the company is slowly starting to grow. And hopefully in the second half of this year, they will already start with the scaling process and so on. But yeah, it was almost a year that we were really back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until he realized that he just doesn't want to step into the role. Well, the thing is, you know, when you start a business, when you are an entrepreneur, you start, you know, on a small scale. You start yourself, maybe, and you are doing what you love and so on. But then as your company grows, there is a need for more structure, structure in HR sense as well. And at one point, you know, you need a CEO, CFO, CMO, and so on. When you know, you have, I don't know, 100, 200, and so on people, you need that structure. And either you have a choice. You can either step into that new role, new way of doing things, or you have to step away and find somebody who can take that forward instead of you. There's no other way of doing it, at least no other way that I would know.
Yeah, I'm wondering how he feels about this. My thinking is that after he finally worked his way through that process, you know, this is my company, I want to do it my way, and it took a year, so apparently it was a very painful process for him. But I'm guessing that now that he has made that decision to step back and, you know, let somebody else create the culture and create the business that needs to be created, or, you know, brought back up from Phoenix, from, you know, like the Phoenix from the ashes. But how does he feel now? I'm guessing that he's like, huh, what took me so long? Why was I so afraid of failure? And it's,
yes,
probably he considered it a personal failure.
Well, the thing was that why he wasn't ready to let go had nothing to do, often it's the ego, you know, I created the company, I should
right.
be the CEO.
Mine.
His case,
you can't tell me what to do, right?
Yeah, in his case, it was more trust, you know, how can I trust somebody else that they will lead the company in the right way? And by creating a system with checks and balances, and here's where a BI solution, business intelligence solution, comes in handy. Because every single day, whenever he wants, he can log into his BI account, and he has all the important KPIs in real-time data, and he knows exactly what's happening. So this is the work I've done then later on with him, was to teach him how to have checks and balances. So not being a completely passive shareholder, but a more active one, so that he has that trust and trusts the system. And now that he trusts the system, then he was very relieved. And it was a transition. So the first 3 to 4 months was really like back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And then we had, you know, like, okay, so something needs to happen. And then was the decision. Then I think we needed about a month and a half to find a new CEO. And then we had like a 6-month transition period so that he was involved a little bit in creating the foundation, in creating those KPIs and benchmarking and so on, seeing how things are in place and so on, and me coaching him on how to properly use those checks and balances that we were putting in place for him, for his benefit, so that he can feel safe, you know, that somebody is running his company, but that he's in control, knowing what's happening in the company without being in the company every single day. Does that make
exactly.
sense?
It really does, and that leads me to wonder, you know, once he was able to transition through all of that and say, okay, I can give up the reins here, but I do need to be part of it here, I'm guessing, again, I'm just guessing based on what you're telling me, is that now he can relax and look at what's going on and see how the company is operating and see where changes are going to be made, need to be made. But I'm willing to bet that his creativity and his excitement about this company is coming back full bore. Am I right or am I wrong?
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. And those 4 months of back and forth was really the failed coaching. So the thing was, because he came to me because he wanted to scale. Once I did my due diligence, I saw that problems are far from just scaling, but, you know, in the foundational stuff. And then it was really intentionally letting him to fail a bit more, fail a bit more, fail a bit more, while pushing him for the scaling part. And after a few months, like he said, like, now I understand why you're the failed coach. Because, you know, the thing is, pain is by far the biggest motivator for any change. Just remember that. And he had to go through enough pain to be able to say, okay, I can't handle this anymore. Okay, Micha, let's do what you are proposing.
And
now,
one of the things
now,
he's
happy.
I would think that he would be. I mean, just listening to you talk, one of the biggest, you know, the fear of failure, the fear of pain, I think that's what stops us. We're thinking about it. We may not be in it. It may not actively be happening to us. But, you know, we're all pretty imaginative, and we can imagine some of the worst darn things. And I think that will stop us quicker than anything. So, oh, I don't want to do that. I'm going to fail. Or, you know, my house is going to burn down. Oh, don't, you know, and we can scare ourselves to death before we even make a move. So I understand.
No, yeah. I mean, it was a scary thing for him. But, again, we did it in a very controlled way, in a very step-by-step way. And, you know, I made sure that he was constantly present with the transition period, that he was informed on top, that he had checks and balances put in place and so on, so that he was every day trusting the system more and more and more and more. And it was only when enough trust was built where he was really willing to let go.
I love that story. Do you know we are out of time? We ran out of time actually about 3 minutes ago, but I didn't want you to stop.
Okay,
listen,
okay,
Micha, where? Oh, this happens. Listen, the thing about this podcast is I get to meet terrific people from all over the world, all over the globe, and I get to, you know, I hate this term, but I get to pick your brain, and I've seen it in your calendar, so you have a pick your brain thing on your calendar. But it's, you know, I get to meet people like you that teach me things that they're going to be with me forever. And my audience is the same way. They're like, oh, I never even thought of something like that. So thank you for being here. And before I let you go, where can people find you on the web?
Well, first of all, I hope it was valuable. I know I can do some rambling along the way. And, you know, you have to excuse a little bit that English is only my third language, and so sometimes, you know, it's a little bit hard for me to express myself super quickly, and so I do go a little bit too much around. But the easiest way for people to find me is just go to Google and search Fail Coach. I'm still the only one out there, so. I think like first 3 or 4 or 5 pages of the results will be my LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and so on. And then they can choose whichever platform they prefer the most and connect with me there, with me and my team. That's by far the easiest way.
I've connected with you all over the place, so you'll see that I'm following you on Instagram and LinkedIn and Facebook, so we're connected. Micha, thank you. It has been wonderful speaking with you, and I love that, you know, this is only your third language. I have 2, English and cursing, and I try not to use a second language. And I never do it in public, just so y'all know. But listen, before, thank you so much for, you know, everything that you've shared with our audience. I really appreciate it. And before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes and honestly anywhere else you consume your business podcasts. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Micha, thank you again.
Thank you.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.